Doom Patrol, Negative Man, Elastigirl, Robot Man.
Someone wants the Doom Patrol reunited.
Your every word and action
is being broadcast across the planet.
Now, Monsieur Mana!
Well done, my Doom Patrol. Well done.
It is too late for you, Calder. Your beloved patrol is doomed.
Hello and welcome to Waiting for Doom, the Doom Patrol podcast, where we're not waiting very long for the Doom Patrol to come back. It's quite soon.
Yes, hello, I'm Mike. You can find me on Twitter at avantgarve. You can reach us at waitingfordoom@gmail.com. You can also reach out to migratedadventure80.blogspot.com, where a friend of the show, Doug Zavisha, adds more magic to this show with lots of interesting panel shots and commentary on the past episodes. You can find our Waiting for Doom Facebook page, and all our episodes are available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Podbean.com.
I'm Paul, and you can find me on Twitter at reading_Hicks. And you can get in touch with Wilfred, the Sentient Show Twitter account, at WFDPod. And we are sponsored by Comicosity, their fantastic comic website.
Indeed. My favourite thing on there this week is an article by Matt Santori-Griffith, titled Dissecting the King in Black Trilogy, which is a really cool article about some recent work by a young up-and-coming hot writer called Tom King, some people may have heard of. And it looks at the series he's written, Amiga Men, Vision, and Sheriff of Babylon, and some of the themes that carry across each of those in a really dark yet interesting way. So that was a really cool read. So tip of the hat to Matt for that one. Yeah.
Awesome. And today we are joined by Stephen Lacey, who's from the Fantastic Ass podcast, which is a podcast about the Fantastic Four. So welcome, Steve.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Awesome. Now, do you want to tell us a little bit about your experience with comics and fandom and podcasting and just the, you know, the quick Stephen Lacey story?
I've been a regular comics buyer for the past something like 14 years. I'm one of those people who saw the Daredevil movie and then went to a shop to buy a Daredevil comic. I'm that guy. And in case you think, oh, that's because you saw the movie and thought, I must find some good Daredevil, I actually quite like the movie. cinematic release as well. I've never seen the director's cut. I know, I'm just, listeners are immediately discounting anything I've got to say. But yeah, I've been a comics reader regularly for that amount of time, although I've been reading stuff from before then. At some point along the way, I found the Fantastic Four and kind of fell in love a little bit. And yeah, it's not easy being a Fantastic Four fan. I mean, can you imagine being a fan of a classic comic series that is kind of abandoned by its publisher and not printed, no new material being published? I don't know if you guys can empathize at all.
Oh, man.
Hey, at least yours is coming back.
True.
But for the past, oh gosh, it's, blimey, it's getting on for 5 years. That's only just hit me. Oh dear. But yeah, for the past 5 years or so, a little less than, I've been podcasting about the Fantastic Four with my good friend Andrew Leyland of Hey Kids Comics. And our show, The Fantastic Us, is one of those shows that takes the first issue as a starting point and just carries on. So we're very much inspired by the formerly defunct and now returning Amazing Spider-Man classics, or From Crisis to Crisis, in that we are that journey through comics show.
Index show, they call them, don't they?
Yeah. Oh, is that what we're called? Oh, it's good to know how we're categorized.
Yeah, an index show starts at the start and works its way through historically.
Yeah, so we've been going since, we've been looking at comics from the beginning of the Marvel Age of Comics in, August 1961 when the first issue was released, and we've made our way through to 1975 at the moment across nearly 200 episodes. We've covered everything. We've done every issue of the Fantastic Four, we've done every issue of Johnny Storm's Strange Tales adventures, which are, yes, they are. We've done... They're not exactly the high bar in quality of 60s Marvel, but we read them, so you don't have to. We've done every guest appearance and cameo. We're currently knee-deep in Steve Gerber's Marvel 2-in-1, which is just a fantastic read, and we're really enjoying the sort of mid-70s craziness and all the good and bad that comes along with it.
Yeah, and your show has a great tone. It's kind of like, it's quite equivalent to ours, really. You know, you guys aren't afraid of a joke, and... you know, a little bit of mocking, and you know, you like to put a song at the end of the show.
Yes, thank God no music lawyers have ever listened in nearly 200 years. episodes. I won't be going that long. But yeah, if they ever listen, we're in a lot of trouble.
I have that fear sometimes too on this show. Yeah.
But I mean, around the tone of it, I think especially 60s Marvel Comics, when they miss the mark, they kind of deserve a bit of mocking, because if you've read through any 60s Marvel, especially the earlier stuff, you know that the tone of the and quality of the comics is widely variable, and you've got to kind of approach that, and you could sit there and just go for an hour, well, this is a crap comic, look at that art, it's crap, why has he said that, that's crap. You could keep doing that, but that makes for a very boring show. So it's much more interesting to have some fun with it, and the tone of the comics in general is fun, so you know, go with it, and it's what we enjoy doing. It seems to resonate with the listeners.
Fantastic.
We don't advocate hate reading or hate watching. even though we're gearing up to watch last year's film, we'll still try and avoid hate watching it.
Oh, so have you seen that before?
I went to the press screening in London. I was a bit lucky. A friend of the show, a guy called James Hunt, who also does a podcast called Cinematic Universe, he's a film reviewer and media writer. He had a spare ticket to the press screening and invited me along. So I'm very pleased. I didn't get to pay any money to go see it. And you walked into the press screening and they were offering you beer and pizza, and that immediately set a tone of just how worried the studio were. And I spent the entire film sat next to Rich Johnson, a bleeding cool.
Wow.
Oh.
Did he get any gossip?
He let slip a few things which I absolutely can't repeat. Because one, I doubt their veracity, and two, there's some mental images involved that I do not need to give you. But it was I have an interesting relationship with Rich, but I genuinely appreciate when I came out of that film and was kind of genuinely quite angry about some of the things that had happened within it. And for the record, it's not completely terrible.
Right.
It gets close to it, but there are some interesting things within it. And if the studio had actually let Josh Trank have his vision, it would be a better film to judge. But it's a bit hard to judge when the filmmaker only gets to make the film up until about the 2/3 mark, and then someone else makes the rest of it.
My comment when I saw it was, you know, the first half of the film is quite good, but it's not really the Fantastic Four. And then the second half is really bad.
Yeah. Oh, it's like reading, say, an appropriate name to bring up, but it's like reading the Grant Morrison Fantastic Four miniseries that he did in the early 2000s, where it's a good interpretation of the Fantastic Four without actually being the Fantastic Four, except in a few small ways. But Rich was kind of, we were chatting afterwards, and he was able to pull out some things that I was too emotionally invested in how bad it was to recognise.
It's on-spot therapy.
Something like that, yeah. that's kind of a bit about me and what I do. And if you want to check us out, I'll throw the link in now casually and watch it get edited in the edit. But you can find us at thefantasticast.com or at Fantasticast on Twitter. And yeah, there's a few great episodes that you can sort of tease out to jump on with, or just pick your favourite issue and jump in.
Fantastic. Now, at this stage, we usually talk about what's been happening in our week in comics. So, Steve, would you like to go first?
Okay. It's one of those weird weeks where not very many comics come out that I buy, because I don't tend to buy many, or indeed any, Marvel comics. So I've not actually had many new comics, but I did get to do something awesome that's comics related this week. I live in London, and I'm lucky enough, through choice a number of years ago, my local comic shop is Orbital Comics, which is the Eisner Award winning retailer. They picked up the Eisner this year for best comic shop.
Nice.
And first of all, it's really awesome to go in there and just see an Eisner on the shelf. Like, what? But Orbital provide an amazing program of events outside of just buying comics. And this week they launched a book called The Mighty One, which is Steve McManus's memoirs of his time editing 2000 AD in the 1980s.
Oh, wow.
And They had kind of the entire 2000 AD crew down. They had Steve there, obviously. He was signing and doing a talk about the book, being interviewed. It's a really good read, and it was nice to connect with 2000 AD. I read it, I get it weekly on my iPad, but I don't often feel connected to it because I don't tend to see the 2000 AD crew at conventions in the same way that I see other creators in the UK whose books that I read. So it was nice to connect with that and to have a really fun night of comics. There were plenty of comics people there. We then moved to a pub, and there may have been some comics people there as well. We then moved to a club, and then I just remember it took a really long time to get home. But yeah, it was nice to do something a little special with regards to comics this week. So yeah, and the book's strongly recommended. It's not even out yet. That's how good it is.
Wow.
Well, not too many people can say they've been inside an Eisner Award winner.
God. No, they can't, Paul. No, they can't.
I'm censoring myself right now. Carry on.
How's your week in comics and stuff been, Paul?
Good, yeah, fantastic. I got the Mega Man trade in the mail yesterday.
Ooh, nice.
So I found a little bit of time last night and read a third of it.
Cool.
Yeah, and it's really good. I can see what the fuss is about. That Tom King seems to be a man who writes very methodically and cleverly. And one of the things I noticed was I've heard him mention this in an interview, that he repeats his structure from, you know, panels all the way through the book to the center, and then he copies it in reverse at the back, so that if you flip through the back and look at the panel structures there, it's a mirror image of the front of the book.
Ooh.
So
I did not know that.
I'll have to reread the whole thing now.
That's the Watchman trick, isn't it?
Sort of, yeah.
Kind of, yeah.
But what a lot of work to do. Wow.
It's worth it, though. It's a great read.
Yeah.
I actually got to meet Tom at HeroesCon this year, and I took a copy of Omega Men number 1 for him to sign, and he was amazed that someone from Australia was there at the show. And he was really curious to see if the copy I had was changed in any way for the local audience. Like whether it was whether the barcode was different, or whether they edited it slightly differently in any way. And I was like, no, it's, as far as I know, it's come straight from America. And he was like, oh, wow, okay, that's cool. I just had to check. I was like...
Did he think they sort of just Aussied up the slang and stuff?
Maybe he did. I didn't. I was a bit too shell-shocked to ask him further.
I mean, there was that thing in the 70s where, for instance, in the UK, you'd get Marvel Comics, but the difference would be the price would be in pence printed on the cover as opposed to cents, which is really annoying when I accidentally buy one in a sale or a comic shop and realise, no, I've got the British version. Great. It makes no difference at all, but it affects my OCD.
Wow. Yeah, no, it's called the Flaming Omega Men down here.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Flaming Omega Men.
Yes. Mike, how was your week?
Fairly quiet, comics and pop culture-wise. I've only read a couple of comics this past week. But one of them that really stood out to me was the first issue of a new series called Animosity from Aftershock Comics, written by Marguerite Bennett and art by Rafael De La Torre, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and Rob Schwager and Marshall Dillon, they're filling out the art team. And for those that haven't read it or heard anything about it, imagine today every animal on the planet kind of could start talking and could start telling humans what they really think about them and start getting revenge on humans. It's,
I'd be in a lot of trouble.
It was action-packed and moved very briskly. And I'm like, where's the second issue? It was really cool. So that was probably the highlight of what I read. But yeah, I picked up a few more comics and added them straight to the to-read pile, which never seems to end. So maybe this weekend. Who knows? We'll see.
Awesome. Okay, so shall we take a look at what Nick Derrington and Gerard Way have been up to in the last week?
Let's.
So, we haven't heard a lot from Derrington Way this week. I think they're lying low because they know what next week is, and that's, I won't spoil it. Maybe the Doom Clock will tell us. But I think they're just waiting and seeing. But we did see there were some young animal posters that went out to the comic shops. Mm. So there is a Doom Patrol poster out in the wild now. I have talked to my local comic seller and asked them, is there a chance that I might have one? I'm yet to get a response to that, but we shall see. Yeah. And
those posters look good. I was in Glasgow for a wedding last weekend, and the Forbidden Planet there had all four right in the centre of their main window. And it's like, wow, this is actually coming. Okay.
Mm. Yeah, I guess we're going to speculate. How big a deal is this going to be for comic retailers? Do you think this will be a bestseller?
I don't know. I don't know if there's the power behind it to make it a bestseller. What there is the ability to draw in readers who might not be going to a comic shop regularly. Gerard Way is a big draw to people outside of comics in a way that 99% of the people on the show who are writing comics right now aren't.
Mm. Yeah,
I think retailers are going to see a lot of new people, and I think the true success is what they can do to get them coming back for the next issue or to get something else into their hands.
Yeah, certainly we've noticed a lot more people tweeting about trying Grant Morrison's run for the first time with the new reissue trades that are about. So,
which stopped just before this issue today. I'm really annoyed at that.
Well, you have got this issue, I hope.
Yes, yes. I thought I'll get the trade it's in as well. I remember the last trades were about a decade ago, and yeah, they've not caught up with the current release.
So, apart from that, there's a little bit of shenanigans on Twitter with Nick Darrington showing off his homemade Danny the Planet action figure, which was suspiciously like a globe of the world, a standard globe of the world, I thought.
Yeah, yeah.
Have a nice stand for an action figure. But yeah, but apart from that, I think we're just all holding our breath.
Yeah, something like that. Mm.
So for things like ticking, is that ticking?
Yeah, that is ticking, and it's the Doom Clock. So looking at the face of the Doom Clock, it's telling us that the last Doom Patrol book we had in our hands was issue 22 of Volume 5 from the Giffen Clark run. That was cover dated July 2011 and went on sale May 4th of that same year, so it's been 5 years and 18 weeks since the last Doom Patrol book. But the first issue of Volume 6 is only 1 week away, September 14. I hope everyone has pre-ordered it and is ready to slap their cash down on the countertop and say, I will have one or one of each Doom Patrol number one. Thank you, shopkeep.
One Doom Patrol, please. Comic seller.
Gladly, young man. Here you go. Or something like that. So, yes, I'm hoping I will get, if not all, most of the variant covers, because that's the first time it's really happened for the Patrol, and I'm very excited. Anyway, yes, so 1 week, we're back with brand new Doom Patrol. No idea what's going to happen to the Doom Clock after that, because, it's going to be a bit odd to say, oh, it's only been 3 weeks since we last saw the Doom Patrol book. but we'll see what happens. The last appearance of the team was 1 year and 4 weeks ago in two different books, All-Star Section 8, number 3, and Justice League United, number 12. And this week in Doom Patrol history, going on sale for $1.95 US on September 7th, 1993, cover dated October 93, was Doom Patrol Volume 2, Issue 71, from Rachel Pollack and Linda Medley. This issue was titled The Fox and the Crow, and it featured a generational war between Fox's force of retirees and Crow's preteen Wild Girls. And we've mentioned the Wild Girls briefly back in the episode where we talked about the two Doom Patrol annuals, because they were sort of used in the Children's Crusade annual that Pollack wrote. Not Pollack wrote, but it was that era. What I also like about this issue is that it's one of the few times that the two key creatives, the writer and the artist, were both women, which is a rarity for the Doom Patrol. So that's, and I think Linda only ended up doing about 8 issues of that run. So yeah, that was nice to see there. And this was also the Patrol that I first got into as well. I think I first encountered them during when that Vertigo Jam one-shot came out. that was kind of like a taster comic of all the different Vertigo titles at that time. And it was just as Pollack had come on board. And yeah, so this was one of the... 71 was one of the first Doom Patrol issues I ever actually read back in the day. Memories. Oh, good times. Anyway, that's it for the Doom Clock this week.
The Fantasticast is your guide to the Fantastic Four from the beginning of the Marvel Age of Comics in 1961 onwards.
Each week, Steve Lacy and Andy Leyland cover every issue, spin-off, guest appearance and cameo, and more.
And in 2015, we begin our journey through the decade that Taste forgot, the 1970s.
Join us as we take a look at...
the departure of Jack Kirby and Stan Lee.
The Kree-Skrull War.
The arrival of Marvel Team-Up.
Bill Murray as the Human Torch.
Creators including Roy Thomas, George Perez, Marv Wolfman, Jerry Conway, Rich Buckler and John Byrne.
And of course, Marvel 2-in-1.
All this and more at ffcast.libsyn.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
The Fantastic Cast.
Insert catchy tagline here. Wait, what?
Today on Doomsplain, we're looking at just a single issue of Doom Patrol, but it is Doom Patrol Volume 2, Issue 53, which was, it's a special issue. There's something about it that sort of reminds us of other comics of the past, which it could be reminding us of Fantastic Four, which may be why we invited a Fantastic Four expert onto the show. Anyway,
I missed that.
Uh-oh.
Oh, it's obvious now.
It's quite subtle. You may not have noticed. Anyway, this is Doom Patrol 53. It was cover dated March 1992, but according to Mike's much more accurate Amazing World of Comics, it came out on February the 4th, 1992. It was $1.50, which was a pretty good price for a comic. It was written by Grant Morrison. We've heard of him. And the art is by Ken Stacey. So diverging from the usual creative team for the Doom Patrol at this point. And it has a cover by Michael S. Kane, who I believe is known as Shaky Kane somewhere around the traps. And the letters are by John E. Workman Jr., the famous letterer still working today on Batman and other things. And it was all coloured by Daniel Vozzo, and it's a fantastic-looking cover in several ways. But anyway, I'll take us through what's inside, and then we will dissect it and learn about it with Stephen's expertise. Anyway, so I have pinched this synopsis off the net because I was... we're pressed for time, and I found a very good synopsis. So I don't know who wrote it, but it came from the DC Wikia. So I'd like to thank the anonymous author of this synopsis. You will be remembered vaguely. Anyway.
Let's hope they are.
As dusk falls on Danny the Street, he sleeps and he dreams. On the far edges of the known universe are the supernatural guardians of the planet Earth, the mighty mystics. From their satellite, the Hand of Warning, Hellblazer keeps watch gloomily over mankind. Unfortunately, something big is headed his way, and the Phantom Stranger warns that this threat could be more dangerous than any they have yet faced. As such, he has called the others for help. Among them are Dr. 13, the Multiple Man, and Mr. E, the Malleable Medium. Hellblazer explains that a massive etheric power source is gathering at the threshold of the multi-dimensions. He suspects that something is waiting to force its way in at its moment of conjunction. They will need further help to deal with it. So Dr. 13 sends for his other 12 multiples, who soon arrive on Manhattan Island, home of the Legion of the Strange. There, a battle is already underway. Automaton fights the Negative Man. As unbeknownst to the others, the brain inside Automaton's body is not Cliff Steele's, but that of Norman Caesar, an embittered scientist, tired of living in the shadow of Niles Calder, with whom he shares his initials. As he tries to squeeze the life out of Negative Man, Elastawoman is forced to tear them apart, chastising Cliff for his behavior. Though Caesar tires of the charade, pretending to be Automaton and a good person, the call of the action klaxon signals that the chief wants their attention. Having spoken to the mighty mystics, he has agreed to send the Legion of the Strange to help fight the weirdness in space. But first, they must investigate a connected event. A tenement building in the Bronx seems to be warping into superspace. Though they do not know what they will find there, they do know one being who might know, the living guru, Advisius to Celestius, the man god. Celestius has been trapped in superspace by the elderly gods during their last dimensional concurrence eons ago, having done no wrong but to create an alternate Earth on the far side of the sun. For that, he was imprisoned behind the Wonder Wall. Soon, though, he will be free. In the Bronx, the Legionnaires investigate the strange building, though Automaton's companions are beginning to suspect something is wrong with him. Inside, though, he is distracted by the call of a young blind girl. Feeling her implicit trust, he senses a change within him, but he has little time to think on it as the roses of the wallpaper start to become real and collapse into a vortex of chaos from which Celestius emerges free. Seeking flesh to sustain him, he demands the child. As a lusty woman and negative man rescue the other inhabitants, they are suddenly blasted back by an explosion from within the tenement building. Inside, Automaton defends the girl with his fists, knowing that he is no match for Celestius. Even so, he refuses to give up, thrusting Celestius back towards the open portal that will send him into the destructive flux of the multi-dimensions during the period of conjunction. Nothing will survive passing through it again. This, of course, is exactly Automaton's plan. However, in their struggle, he too is thrown into the void, and the portal closes behind them. Having watched their descent into the void, the girl got a glimpse into the infinite, which bestowed the gift of sight upon her, and her savior was gone. Finally, the rest of the Legionnaires arrive and find their friend gone. The chief explains, though, that it was never their friend Cliff. Cliff's brain has been in a jar in his possession this whole time. Whoever had taken his place is long gone and may have redeemed himself or whatever had driven him to take over Cliff's body in the first place. He died a hero after all. Though the story has a happy ending, Danny's Dreaming has a bonus feature, The Secrets of Man-Hatton Island. Having been out of commission for most of the previous story, Cliff Steele now has the opportunity to show readers around the headquarters on Man-Hatton Island. In the head of the island, the chief creates his gadgets and inventions to use against supervillains. There he finds the chief, expecting him to be creating some fancy gizmo, but in fact, he's merely boiling an egg. Wah, wah, wah.
Oh, dear.
Right, so how do we approach this one? I've said the name of several familiar characters, but they are presented in unfamiliar ways in this comic. So we see a Cliff Steele, or Automaton, as he's known in this, who looks very bulky and he smokes a cigar. Yes, who does he remind anyone of?
Shall I step in? this issue is crap. I'm so glad you did, Steele, the synopsis, because, yeah, I wouldn't know where to begin with this either. But yeah, I mean, the obvious thing is, if you haven't quite picked this up, this whole thing is a massive riff on Jack Kirby and Stan Lee's Fantastic Four. Mm-hmm. And when I say massive riff, I mean Grant Morris has basically stolen the plot to Fantastic Four issue 51, This Man, This Monster, and then worked his way around that.
Wow.
Throwing stuff in. So, and if you're not familiar, This Man, This Monster is the famous issue that came just after the Galactus saga, which involves... a random scientist, we never find out his name. He basically steals the Thing's powers and thus his appearance, masquerades as the Thing, supposedly to destroy the Fantastic Four, then ends up sacrificing himself in the negative zone to save Reed, as he kind of comes to understand what a hero is. And that's effectively what's done here.
Yeah.
And it's a very touching turnaround of motivations, and it is kind of almost exactly what happens with Automaton in this issue.
Ah. Already dropping the knowledge. I did not know that.
No, not right.
Yeah, and the title of this comic is "And Men Shall Call Him Hero," which sort of calls back to This Man, This Monster. It's a dramatic title with an exclamation mark.
You know what? I don't have a hard copy nearby. I'm just going to double check, because I have this horrible feeling that's actually the quote from the end of the book.
Ah.
Where have I got a digital copy of this? This is one of those points where the funny music plays for the interstitial, because me trying to find a PDF on my hard drive is not very interesting. And I'll probably be wrong anyway, so this is all completely useless. Ah, spinny disk of doom, come on. No, the end of the issue is that he paid the full price and he paid it like a man. So yeah, no, there isn't that quote at all.
So close. It
feels like a Stan Lee-ism. It feels like this is one of his, when he's writing his caption boxes minutes before it goes to press and his muse is just running away with him.
Right. And of course, the art is all done in a very Kirby style throughout. Like, there's Kirby dots everywhere. Everyone is very dramatic. And we get reinterpretations. So, Hellblazer, I mean, he is John Constantine Hellblazer, but he is in a superhero outfit. So, he has like.
This version of Hellblazer made me laugh so much. I can see why Alan Moore hates Grant Morrison. But this version, this chain-smoking superhero with his big buff muscles and his terrible, terrible Cockney accent.
Mm-hmm.
Stryker Lloyd, why don't you blokes quit flapping your jaws and have a deco here? deco for a start is such an archaic bit of slang. I think it was archaic back in 93, let alone today.
Yeah, and he's got a great big red cape, and he has like a candelabra with spear points on his chest or something, which has H and B across it. And then the Phantom Stranger walks in, and he is dressed as a full-on superhero. So he's got a domino mask. I mean, everyone has domino masks.
Yeah.
He's got a great big skull on his crotch, and he's got PS on the front of his outfit. And he's
that Phantom Stranger. He seems to be like a cross between Moon Knight and Raven.
Yeah, yeah. He's got the gem on his forehead and the pointy cowl like Raven has.
Yeah. And at the bottom of page three, they break the cardinal rule for Phantom Stranger. They show his eyes.
Yes.
For all you can say about how bad the Dan DiDio written Phantom Stranger was, at least they never showed the eyes.
Yeah, and then we get Dr. 13, the multiple man, who's in a green and orange spandex with his glasses. But he has all these multiples with numbers on their chests. And he seems to have disturbed a flock of mallards as he leaps into action. So all these ducks are flying everywhere with him.
What I like about this multiple man, and this is just the coincidence, I believe the episode is out just after this one, but we've just covered Giant Size Fantastic Four number 4, which is the first appearance of Madrox the Multiple Man, which Jamie Madrox, basically if he takes physical force, he creates dupes of himself, which is sort of similar to what's going on here. And I suspect this is the riff, because by this point, Jamie Madrox is well known through Peter David's X Factor.
Yep.
But I really like the idea that there's just 13 of these guys. There's no special thing about, you hit them and suddenly there's more. There's just 13 of them. They've all got different numbers and boring glasses. I mean, did you ever read the Brian Azzarello, Cliff Chang, Dr. 13 series that ran in the back of a Tales of the Unexpected series from 2008, something like that?
Yeah, I'm a massive fan of that. That's a fantastic little series. And it really, it's very meta in a clever, funny way.
Yeah.
Oh, very. Don't they reveal at one point the architects of the universe are like Dan DiDio and Jeff Johns and Greg Rucka and Grant Morrison or something like that?
Yeah. They do exactly that. And Mark Waid is in there too.
Yes. Oh, yes. Back in the days when Mark Waid was still working for DC. Ah, good days.
But Dr. 13 appears to be bird watching, so all these ducks around him, and he's giving bananas and pineapples to the ducks.
What I love is Dr. 2 has this duck right in front of him, but he's still got a pair of binoculars just in case he's going to miss it.
Yeah, and then we have Mr. E, who's like a cross between Elongated Man and, I don't know, he's got a cane, but he can stretch. It's just so stupid. And his sunglasses.
Well, that could be a bit of a riff on the idea that Thor's secret identity, Don Blake, was lame and had the cane. But we did a Marvel team-up issue where he was taking a cab, and he was looking and going, why would Don Blake take a cab? You'd strike your cane on the ground, zoom across town as Thor. Why would you waste the money?
I also wonder if Mr. E is also a riff on, I'm sure there was another Vertigo character with that name, or sort of in that dark mysticism side of DC Universe, like Hellblazer and Phantom Stranger. So I wonder if they've matched that with Reed Richards as well, because I'm sure he had a cane as well.
Ah, yeah.
There's a... there's a Mr. E. So Wikipedia tells me there's a Mr. E who appeared in Secrets of Haunted House, but then was used in The Books of Magic by Neil Gaiman.
That was blind mystic who was quite callous and very rough on Tim Hunter.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, the Books of Magic kid.
Yep.
One, the Harry Potter before there was Harry Potter, that guy.
Ooh.
And of course, there was Mr. E was also the lead guitarist of The Eels.
Oh, right. Of course. That's right. Morrison covered all bases now.
Anyway, we see their base, and it is a city in the middle of New York that is the shape of a man. So it's got really tall buildings where the feet are.
It's brilliant. It's Manhattan Island, Manhattan, which I just the some of the jokes in this. Like, if you take a look at that panel where you see Manhattan Island, there's a little plane flying. It's called Tempest Flight. It's a terrible joke, but I love it.
Time flies.
Yeah,
and he's got a pointy building where the penis should be too. And
one of the ducks is flying in.
There used to be a ship coming out of his bottom.
Oh, Paul.
Just say things, okay? It doesn't say anything about my mind.
No, not at all.
I love that one of the ducks is apparently part of the Doctor 13 crew. He takes off and he's flying in. It's like, yeah, why not have a duck as a sidekick?
Yeah, why not?
Anyway, inside we see the Doom Patrol in action, or the Legion of the Strange, I think, instead. Mm-hmm. So we have a negative man who's pretty standard. Like, he's got the bandages, but he has like a superhero spandex on as well. So sort of bandaged arms and face, and then the rest is spandex. And there's the negative energy, which just looks a little more spectral than normal.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the Automaton, who is the bulky version of Cliff Steele, very like the Thing.
Yes.
But we have an imposter inside. And then we see Elasti Woman, and it's Kay Challis. So it's a Crazy Jane is actually Elasti Woman in this one.
Hmm. Except she's just got Rita Farr's power and not the multiple powered personalities. Yeah.
I love when she's grabbing them. She's just kind of put her head slightly through the roof.
You see, this is what I love about being here with you guys. I would not have picked up on the Kay Challis name because my knowledge of the Doom Patrol is okay, but it's very layman's, and I would have absolutely missed that this was Crazy Jane.
Mm.
Ah.
Because I would have just gone with the visuals.
Yeah. What I do like about this scene, though, is that it definitely reminds me of, I guess we'll call it the friendly rivalry between Ben and Johnny. In the Fantastic Four, how they're always at each other. I think this page and the preceding one capture that really well.
Yeah.
Apart from the bit where Phil Thompson's just like, yeah, I could squeeze the very life from this insect. Ah, shucks, it was just larks.
Well, yeah, other than that, sure, yeah.
But then the action klaxon sounds, and then we ooga, ooga across the page. And then we see the chief fly in, and he's got like a lounge chair, but he's got controls and jets out the back. But it's got the reclining footrest. And that's his power control.
I see that with the lever and the lever, because I'm English. And all I can think of is Martin Crane in Frasier. It's that chair.
Yeah,
Frasier would not be happy if Martin's chair had rockets.
No, not at all.
Yeah, I love that he has crazy Kirby eyebrows.
Mm.
Oh, he does, doesn't he? I mean, who's the artist on that? I need to scroll back. Ken Stacey is doing this amazing Kirby pastiche, but there's something about the first time you see Chief's face which really taps into, I think, the DC Kirby, the New Gods style, because, I mean, there are plenty of hairy characters within that, and yeah, it just really evokes that feel in those few panels.
Yeah. It reminds me, did you ever read 1963, the Image series?
No.
Is that the Alan Moore thing?
Yeah, Alan Moore sort of pulled it together, and they basically made sort of affectionate parody of the Marvel Universe. So they had lots of sort of parody titles. I think there's about six titles that came out.
Right. No, I haven't. I feel like I really should because I happen to have read pretty much everything Marvel published in the 60s, but also if it was Image, it would definitely be after Alan Moore had decided that creators' rights were worth making a stink about. And Marvel and creators' rights, yeah.
Yeah, well, this 1963 came out in 1993, so it would have, it's probably in Grant Morrison's head at the same time as 1963 was in Alan Moore's, and they probably brought them out at the same time. Coincidence? Who knows? Anyway, but yeah, they're both very affectionate. So I think Alan Moore wrote Mystery Incorporated, which was his take on the Fantastic Four, which is a cool little story if you've not read it. But my understanding is Rick Veitch and Steve Bissett and all them would love to get these published, but Alan Moore is a dick and won't let anyone reprint them.
It's a bit of a recurring theme, isn't it? Alan Moore's not the only one who does that. Grant Morrison was against Zenith ever being reprinted. 2000 AD series he did, which was, you know, okay for him, but Steve Yeol, the artist, was very much for it being reprinted. And eventually they worked out a way of doing it, but it was denying effectively money for Steve Yeol because it's one of his most famous works and could never be bought legally for quite some time.
That's why I have photocopies of Zenith for the last 12 years.
Oh wow. Wow.
Photocopied directly from the 2000 ADs. So.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I got them sort of ring-bound quite nicely.
Okay.
Anyway, let's move on with the comic. So then we see the Living Guru, who is a guy with six arms floating in space, a giant egg-shaped head, bald, and he has a third eye in the middle of his head. And he is floating in amongst all sorts of vortexes and watch pieces and starfishes and things.
So I kind of want to talk about this page a little, because what's being done here is Kesey's doing this fantastic riff on something that Jack Kirby did in the 60s at Marvel, which was these amazing photo collage spreads where he'd abandon the idea of fully penciling a page and create using God knows what. Half the time I've been unable to even guess at what things are. But he would create these amazing splashes that would be coloured in a very similar way to this, because that's how you kind of handled colouring in photos at the time when you're dealing with cheap paper and cheap printing.
And
that was the Marvel way of doing it. And some of the early ones are a little indistinct because they haven't worked out how to do the printing properly then. But as you move into the ones he did in the late half of the 60s, they are genuinely mind-blowing in terms of what they're doing. And anytime you turn the page and there's one of those there, you are just going, wow. And there's probably about a dozen or so spread across the Fantastic Four and a couple in the more cosmic issues of Thor as well. They are great. I don't even think the original pages exist anymore. I, as an aside, I was very lucky a couple of years ago. I was in Paris and they had an exhibit which was promoed as being just Marvel concept art from the films, and they had some props there from the films like Cap's shield, the uniforms from the Smithsonian exhibit in the Winter Soldier, but they had hundreds of original artwork pages, including about sort of 40 or so Jack Kirby Fantastic Fours, but none of them were the collages. But they did have a Jim Steranko collage cover from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Or the S.H.I.E.L.D. book, if you remember, the one with the melty clocks. They had that there and the various bits held on with sticky tape and stuff. Oh. It was really quite something.
Wow. So this is a send-up of the Watcher, you reckon?
This is, well, yeah. I like the idea of the Watcher being a herald of Galactus. The Watcher observes everything and doesn't interfere. And I like the idea that if Galactus could press a Watcher into service, he could get any planet he wanted. Like, you wouldn't get Skrulls hiding their planet behind a cloud, which is what happened in the very first Galactus issue. This cloud in space. No, there's nothing suspicious there. Clouds often form in space.
Meanwhile, Galactus is like, I guess I'll move along.
Yeah.
And then we see Celestius, who you would say is the Galactus analogue of the issue.
Yes. And I was also, when I was rereading last night, something else occurred to me. Are you guys familiar with Final Crisis?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, I am.
So you know how Grant Morrison likes to connect everything,
mm-hmm.
To the point where I didn't understand a big chunk of the Superman Beyond issues until I read the conclusion of Grant Morrison's Animal Man, where all the League of Forgotten Heroes first appeared. But this, the Vampiric Galactus reminds me of, I want to say, was it Mandrake, the Vampiric Watcher, not Watcher, Monitor. That turns out to be the bad guy in the last issue or so. This reminds me of a proto version of that.
Oh, yeah, it does.
Giant cosmic space vampire. Although it didn't need to be sung away, so.
Yeah, so he appears and he's talking about power and pointing a lot and gesturing, and there's lots of very Kirby-esque thrusting hands forward and things like that. I just love some of the reactions on the guru guy, the living guru, with his waving his arms in a panic when Celestius appears. And surfing chunks of metallic meteorites around.
Oh, surfing? Can't imagine why he'd do that.
No, nothing Kirby-ish about surfing.
No.
So is there anything we're missing here, Stephen?
It's general good giant space god stuff. There's not so much of the Celestials, but I mean... Actually, when the Imperium... what's his name?
Celestius,
that's it. I'm misreading as Celsius, but that didn't make sense. When Celestius is sort of ranting, it very much evoking the Stan Lee style dialogue. Not so much when it's "I'm Celestius and I will be free," but "for mine is the power Imperium." It's yeah, change a word and it's Namor. It's that kind of grand proclamation. And I like some of the world building that's done as well, like the idea that he's been imprisoned by elderly gods. Presumably there's an old people's home full of them going, "I wonder if our younger gods are coming to visit today." And at the top of page 11, he mentions my crime was the creation of the Alter Earth on the far side of the sun, which actually happened in Marvel. The High Evolutionary created Counter Earth on the far side of the sun, where he would control evolution. And that was in the Adam Warlock series from the early 70s, and Counter-Earth would hang around, mostly forgotten about. But occasionally would pop up. I remember the big part played in Fabian Nicieza's Thunderbolts run, and eventually got destroyed by something, probably Galactus.
Because
it was a bit of a continuity nightmare.
I'll bet.
Right, and anyway, then we see there's hijinks in Brooklyn, so that we get this sort of weird, interesting architecture floating in space above Legion of the Strange have arrived, and this sort of... How would you describe this house, Mike? I don't know what's going on.
It's a bit of a mess. It's being built, apparently, according to the chief. It's built from every unfilled closet, every unused drawer, every empty space. It's escaped, rebelled, and combined to form a new superdimensional configuration of hypergeometrical spaces. Of course it has. It reminds me a little bit of, I think it was House of Mystery or House of Secrets. From way back in DC's 60s stuff.
Mm.
So, but yeah, it's kind of, I'm imagining it meant to be sort of being built as they're there talking about it from all this unused space. It's just being filled by this bizarre new building. Mm.
It looks a bit like a Doctor Strange idea too.
A little bit.
It looks a bit mundane for what it's supposed to be. I feel like this crazy house should be operating on multiple levels, like it should be very Escher-esque or something like that, whereas everyone is very clearly, if you look at all the people trapped within, they're very clearly down is down and up is up.
Yeah.
And it's like, surely it should be a bit more weird than that.
Yeah. Anyway, they get into action, and this is when Automaton gets separated from the others and finds the little blind girl.
I love his little chest logo that functions as a flashlight with a question mark in the middle of it. Why would you build a flashlight to help you see with deliberately blacked out bits of it? I mean, it's not like, have you ever seen a Spider-Man issue where he's got the Spidey signal?
Yep.
It always seems to, across the 8 foot, appear to magnify massively at great intensity. And you just think, no, that would be weak and small. But at least that's there to make people notice it. This is a functional thing. Why?
I don't know. Yeah, so he encounters the blind girl. She clings to him. He feels the tug of being a hero instead of a villain. And then that's when Celestia arrives through the wallpaper, this lovely floral wallpaper that turns into real flowers and roses fly everywhere.
That would be a really good cinematic moment if the wallpaper started coming to life like that. Can you imagine if he was in a room and suddenly the roses start pushing out and then coming into the room? I think that would be a really trippy visual.
Mm. Yeah. Sure would.
Just getting back to the blind girl for a moment, Steve, didn't Ben Grimm date a blind woman? And was her name Alicia Masters?
Alicia Masters, yes.
Yeah, I was wondering if, because, I mean, this blind girl's clearly a girl, but it just the interplay between the two of them, like having the Ben Grimm analog and this blind girl, it reminded me of their relationship in the old Fantastic Four books.
Yes, I think just for decency, I should point out Alicia Masters is a grown woman in the Fantastic Four.
Yes, that's
not yes. A 6-year-old girl. Although. Because this is a black girl, and in the Tim Story movies from the mid-2000s, which are not recommended in any way, shape, or form, but Kerry Washington plays Alicia Masters, and that was one of the first cross-racial castings, and no one cared about that back then, whereas everyone cares about everything now. It's like, oh my God, this person is slightly darker than they should be. We must go mad on the internet. No, just go away and stop getting worked up about this. It's absolutely fine. Yeah. So that was a sort of nice little presaging. But yeah, and I'm wondering if the kid aspect is a way of bringing in the idea of, at the time, it would have just been Franklin Richards, the son of Reed and Sue, because this is before Valeria Richards was created, the daughter.
Oh.
So I wonder if that's a way of just combining those two and referencing those two within the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Over the page, I love Elastic Woman helping people out of the building.
Yes.
People are having fun sliding down her arm, and it looks like there's one guy sitting on her arm reclining against her boob.
Yep, he's having a great old time
with his hands. Yeah, I love it.
It's the woman grabbing onto her ankles going, "Wee, this is great." And I love that. It's just dimensions going crazy. There's a giant space vampire coming through the wallpaper, but we'll stop and have some fun.
Yeah.
And you see, the policeman must have just helped a cat off the arm because he's holding a cat.
And I think we're winning, Chief, says one of the two people not doing anything.
There's the Chief zooming around in his chair above them all.
Yeah. I love that comfy hover chair. Yeah.
Yeah, but then we get a kaboom and a great big red explosion, which knocks everyone backwards. And then we see that inside it's Celestius making his move on the girl because he needs to take her energy.
Surrounded by some very impressive Kirby crackle. I'm always a fan of Kirby crackle, which are those dots used to signify energy. And especially when people who aren't Kirby do it well, I become a fan.
Yeah. But this is as close as we get to it. It's clobbering time when Automaton says, "Here's heavy metal for you," and swings back. And he's got like a little pipe that, you know, like a steam pipe that comes out of the back of his head, and that starts blowing smoke as he does this.
Like Popeye, that toot toot.
Oh, dear. But I mean, he's ineffectual against Celestius, who really smacks him through the wall. Yeah, and then he has the whole, you know, "I'm going to try a bit harder," and that's when we get some very Kirby eye blasts from Celestius.
Back in the very first Galactus story, I think it was actually in issue 49, Galactus appears on top of the rooftop and he's sort of 20 foot tall and preparing to suck life from the earth, and Ben decides the best way to take him down is to go and punch the back of his leg. It doesn't go very well. It goes about as well as it goes here. You can't punch a space god.
But I love that Automaton's lying on the ground smoking, like really stuffed up, and then he's suddenly back on his feet and he said, "I ain't down yet," pointing to himself with a thumb, so we know who he's talking about. Then he shoves Celestius into the void.
Well, that's the inspirational power of the small blind girl being helpless. Would you not have thought that Celestius would need slightly more flesh and life force than could be provided by 1 6-year-old girl? If that's all he needs out of the entire multiverse, then
maybe she's just like the initial energy boost, just to get him started. Maybe.
Are you suggesting that she's like the one canapé that you have at a party before you go and sit down for the main meal?
I'll say yes.
She's a vol-au-vent.
Yes.
A vol-au-vent of life force.
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, but, yes, Automaton wins, and this mysterious scientist is gone in the void, and then the girl can see. And then the Doom Patrol all gather, and it's, you know, there's a second of worrying about Cliff. Then Chief has Cliff's real brain in his jar and on his lap.
Yeah, handy.
Yeah.
The void they get trapped in is the negative zone, which people being lost in the negative zone was a repeated plot line across the back half of Lee Kirby Fantastic Four. Although for a while, just an interesting thing, the negative zone wasn't the negative zone. The thing that was known as the negative zone in the Marvel comic was the shield that, or the force field that surrounded the city of Atalan after the Inhumans' first appearance, and they spent 20 issues trying to break through. That was the negative zone, and then once they got rid of the shield, they realized the negative zone was a really good name, so they applied it to something else instead, and that became the negative zone.
Right.
Clear?
Yes. No,
thought not.
Thanks. Dropping the knowledge there. So in the classic Fantastic Four feature, did they do sort of tours of the headquarters like we get in this one to close out?
The classic thing you'd get is you'd get a full-page shot of the Baxter building, but cut away to show all the different rooms that there are in there, like the lab and where the rockets are stored, and screening room, and a room filled with water just in case Namor happens to visit, and all these random things. We'd also look and go, and the bathrooms are where? And the kitchen is where? Because it's like, I remember someone did one of these like schematics of the Enterprise, USS Enterprise D in the early 90s, and they realised by looking at it, there are only two loos on the entire ship. One was just off the bridge, and one was somewhere else. It's like, okay, I guess, do they beam it out of you? If you're in engineering and you need the loo, you just go somewhere, right? But yeah, the cutaway is great, and their headquarters is shaped like a question mark, and the question mark appears to be somewhere in the knee of Manhattan Island. I've just noticed the Central Park is down the middle like a logo on a superhero costume.
Yeah. And you can faintly see a smile in the face.
Yes. And that bridge looks like he's got a cigar in his mouth or a pipe. Or an arrow in the eye, depending on how you're interpreting the face.
Oh dear. We'll have to make sure Doug puts a picture of this one up.
But yeah, there's all sorts of wonderful, fun little bits. Yeah, it would be a thing you'd go back to every now and again, especially if you had an oversized issue of the Fantastic Four. It was a great way of putting some extra content in that wasn't just extending the story or a reprint.
Ah.
So yeah,
they did a lot of reprinting, didn't they?
Yes, there were. So, I mean, the most egregious one, we've just covered it on the show, was Fantastic 454, where everyone was so far behind they literally took a Strange Tales adventure, and not there were really any good ones, but a particularly poor one, whacked it in, and then drew 3 or 4 extra pages of artwork to fill out the issue.
Wow!
And it would really, really not good. The giant-sized Fantastic Fours would often have 2 reprints in the back of. Same with the annuals, you'd get reprints to fill them out. But it wasn't just a Fantastic Four, it was a Marvel thing, because it's a lot cheaper to reprint stuff when you don't have to pay anyone for it.
Oh, yeah, true. Good old Marvel. Say good old DC as well, couldn't we?
Reprints are the worst. I remember getting the 100th issue of Daredevil from the Ed Brubaker run, and it was oversized, and it had two Silver Age Daredevil reprints starring, I think, Mr. Fear. And I was just like, these are terrible. Why have I got these? I know Mr. Fear's in the main book, but these are just terrible. Ooh. Stop charging me money for these.
So anything else we want to say about this one before we finish it up? Did we all enjoy it?
Yes, there are a couple of things I want to throw in, if that's okay. One is that page one is completely different from the rest of the book. It's a different art team, Richard Case and Scott Hanna, and it's just, it reads like, well, I'm assuming a, quote, normal, unquote, issue of Doom Patrol would read.
Yeah, yes. It's just evening on Danny in the Street. So.
Yeah, just yeah. Before, you know, the sentient street goes to bed and has a dream, you know? It's completely normal.
I love that these are steam coming out of the street and the chimneys and stuff. I absolutely love that. Mm. I've never really read much of Danny the Street because my Doom. I've only got the first trade of the Morrison from the original prints, not from the new ones. So it's only the 8 issues or so following whatever happened before, because it's crawling from the wreckage. And yeah, Danny hadn't turned up by that point. So I guess this is how Danny communicates
with pretty much
steam and stuff.
Yeah, the street signs are like there's a banner across the end of the street and it's saying have a lovely evening. That's completely Danny. Yeah,
which I just love. So this one page, Danny is instantly a character that I love. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about the cover, which is by Shaky Kane. I just want to say I love Shaky Kane. I think he's a fantastic artist who more people should be aware of. He does a superb Kirby parody, the poses, especially on I can't say Robot Man, can I? Automaton. It's such a Kirby pose, and the same with not Elastigirl.
Elastiwoman, I think it is.
Crazy Jane, technically. But yeah.
Yeah.
All those things are just great. I actually prefer Shaky Kane's design for Celestius than I do from the one on the inside, because I feel like all those markings on the helmet look far weirder on the front. But yeah, Shaky Kane, great artist, and I'm just take a moment and say, if you can track down the trades of Bulletproof Coffin or Bulletproof Coffin Disinterred, which is Shaky Kane on art and David Hine writing, and they are fairly meta. I think if you like Doom Patrol, you'll probably get on with these. They're riffing on Kirby and also Steve Ditko creator-owned stuff. But also then there's a whole load about what it means to work for hire as opposed to creator owned, what it means if your characters, when your characters stop being published, like there's a Ditko character, I think, called The Fly or something, and there's a very obvious analog for that, but that's not been published for many years. So what happens to that character, and blurring of the lines between reality and fiction, and it's absolutely great. Both of them are fantastic. One of the issues is designed that you cut the issue up into all different panels and just make the issue yourself. And that's how the way they made the issue was they drew all the panels, then mixed them up on the floor, then put them together, and the reader is invited to defer a narrative from that.
Wow.
And then you can cut them up and make your own narrative. But they're great. They're from Image. They're probably not in print, but I'm sure you can find them if you go and have a little bit of a look around. But yeah, Bulletproof Coffin and Bulletproof Coffin Disinterred. Highly recommended.
Okay.
Wow. Never heard of them.
Very sadly, that's the case with almost everyone, but they're brilliant.
Oh, golly. Okay, yeah, it is a great cover. And yeah, Celestius looks much more Galactus-y on the front, doesn't he?
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. All right. Well, I personally really enjoyed these. The first time I read them, I think I just didn't know anything about Kirby, and I hadn't, you know, read any original Fantastic Four, and I didn't get it at all. And I just thought, what is this stupid story interrupting the Doom Patrol? seriously, that's how I reacted the first time. I was quite negative. I remember Chris Sabella said something similar about how he didn't like this issue. How did you find it, Mike?
I've always enjoyed this issue every time I read it because, I guess possibly a bit more than you, Paul, I was aware of what it was riffing on. Having read a bit of, not a whole heap of, but enough of, like Steve was saying, having a layman's knowledge of Patrol, I have, I guess, a layman's knowledge of Fantastic Four from the classic era. I did read Matt Fraction's Future Foundation and his Fantastic Four run from the last couple of years. So I've kind of kept up with them a bit. But yeah, I was, you know, I always really appreciate the Automaton being, you know, this version, this bizarre version of Ben Grimm, and, you know, the whole cosmic adventure stuff going on with Celestius, and yeah, just his rallying cry about having the Power Imperium. And it's like, okay, dude, it's a great homage to you know, that classic Fantastic Four stuff. And yeah. But it was really interesting to know that it essentially riffs off that story you were telling us about, Steve, that one issue.
Yeah.
I never knew that. So that was really cool.
It's a specific homage, not a general one.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed it every time I've read it more. So, the last time I read it was certainly the most I've enjoyed this story. Mm. So if I read it again after, I'll even enjoy it even more now.
Cool.
I genuinely didn't know that this existed until I was contacted about being on the show. And I've read loads of Grant Morrison over the years. And when he gets to play with Kirby stuff, what he tends to do is play with the, obviously, the DC characters, because DC owned them. But you think of Final Crisis, and that has the New Gods. It's got Anthro. It's got the other one, the Commandy.
Commandy.
It's, yeah. And he plays with all of those, and he obviously very invested in New Gods. So I never knew that he did something playing with versions of the Marvel stuff from years ago. And I found it fascinating to read, because also this is early Grant Morrison. The majority of my reading is from JLA onwards.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of the later part of the 90s. So I find this completely fascinating to read. The artwork is such a wonderful pastiche. It does that right balance of referencing how Kirby drew in the 60s, especially under the inks of Joe Sinnott, without just being swiped or ripped off. And yeah, I absolutely adore this. I'm so glad that you brought this to my attention, because I could have gone on for a very long time without ever realizing this existed, and that would have made me very sad if I'd have known that.
Yeah, when we knew this was coming, it was very clear to both of us that we needed a Fantastic Four fan to help us navigate through it. So we're very appreciative of having you here for this.
Well, thank you for thinking of me.
No worries. All right. So we might time for the... we might wrap up the coverage there and come back with the Mailbag of Doom.
Kids Comics.
Hey, Michael.
Yeah?
We need to do a new promo.
A new one?
A new one.
Why?
Because we've moved.
Moved?
Moved. We've moved to a new place. We still read comics.
We do. We still talk about comics.
Because you can't do a comic book podcast unless you read and talk about comics, because that's kind of stupid. But now, we have a new episode still available every Thursday, but at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
Hey, Kids Comics!
So remember, Hey, Kids Comics has moved to twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Still, every Thursday. That'll do, won't it?
So last week on the show, we asked everybody what is their favourite fictional foursome, which is a coincidental question for this issue. Anyway, so we heard from Karthik Karkarella, who said, you, me, and he's talking about Wilfred and himself, and Mike and Paul. I'm not fictional.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a lovely sentiment, but I'm not fictional, Karthik.
I'd love it if you were, and I've been podcasting with two fictions. That would have been really awesome.
Crap, Paul, he's onto us. Nick in Dallas, at Nick in Dallas, he wrote in and said, well, I'm clearly the only one taking this seriously, and he gave us four images, one of Joe Camel, the mascot for Camel Cigarettes. I believe it's Seven's Arc 7 from Battle of the Planets. An elf of some sort from some Harry Potter film. I don't think it's Dobby because it looks too cranky. And I have no idea who the fourth person is, so I'm going to assume that's Nick himself.
It's a footballer. It's got an NFL. Anyway, someone in Dallas who's famous.
Yeah, that's probably Nick who plays. I'm sure Nick plays it. Nick plays for NFL, doesn't he?
I don't know.
Anyway.
I barely know what NFL is, let's be honest.
Gridiron, American football.
We heard from Aaron Long. Aaron Long has trolled us again with the words Archie, Voldemort, Queen Elizabeth, and that guy you keep talking about from the Doom Patrol.
Right. Of course. Ryan Daly at Ryan Daly 01 said Fantastic Four. I know it's obvious, but yeah.
Nice one, Ryan.
Then we had from Dr. Angie said, the Beatles, those guys were unreal. And then he came out with his real answer. I'm afraid it's the FF. But I'm fond of the time Crystal of the Inhumans was a member.
Wetchy Vile Metkin, otherwise known as Kevin or Astrakis One, gave us a single image of Luke, Leia, Han, and Chewbacca from Star Wars.
Yeah, nice one.
Mm. They're not fictional.
We heard from Abel Padzilla, who said, absence has made the heart grow fonder. I miss the original Fantastic Four. Maybe it's time for a Waiting for the FF podcast. You want to
get rebranding.
Yeah. I was going to say, maybe you should tune into the Fantastic Cast. Yeah.
I believe Abel does, yes.
Okay, cool. We also heard from Jessica at Charming Red, and she listed Misty, Valkyrie, Annabelle, and Elsa from The Fearless Defenders. Oh, I love that comic. That was so much fun. It was a great series.
Never read it. We heard from Daniel Walden, who's A Dan on Twitter. He said, fave is hard, but I love the Black Panther Storm FF.
Okay.
Oh, the Dwayne McDuffie stuff, yeah.
Okay.
Post-Civil War, really good run.
Okay. Richie O'Hara Beeman at Rickety OB said, maybe X-Club, which is comprised of Dr. Nemesis, Dr. Kavita Rao, Danger, and Madison Jeffries. They did science, or possibly Moon Knight. Oh, I think I'm being so clever, but chances are I have forgotten a persona. But then he said, how could I have overlooked King's Watch, Mandrake, the Phantom, Lothar, and Flash? Almost certainly my final answer.
love King's Watch.
Yeah, great stuff. Yeah.
I'll throw in for X Club. Brilliant. Especially the Cy Spurrier written miniseries. Okay. Great fun comics.
We heard from Brian Panderson, who's at Panderson Art. You may not know, Brian is a fictional artist himself. So he listed his colleagues Ern Malley, JT Leroy, Brian Panderson, and Alexis the Plaid Salamander Bischoff, true creator of the Voynich manuscript.
Right. Okay, good answer, Brian. Thank you. Yeah. Firestorm fan at Firestorm fan, otherwise known as Shag. The irredeemable Shag. Said his favorite fictional foursome was the Fifth Doctor, Nyssa, Tegan, and Adric.
I sent fan mail to Tegan and got a laundry postcard back from her.
A what?
It was a postcard.
We'll talk after the recording.
True story.
Wow. Okay. Yeah,
I kept that one. we heard from Doug Savisha, who said the whole patrol. Hey.
Yay.
But he also said Luke, Leia, Han, and Chewie.
Nice. Over on Facebook, we heard from Jared Driscoll, who said the challenges of the unknown, only because of the Kirby pencils and Wally Wood inks.
Nice.
We also got an email this week from Dr. Ange, who was kind enough to say that he loved this last episode. The adventure with mutants and killer llamas and junk-punching Yeti was too wild. And Niles was literally a deus ex machina, saving the day by being a god in a machine. The craziest part of this was the Madame Rouge self-battle. In my mind canon, the whole thing took place in her schizophrenic mind. It was a battle of which side of her personality would win. She shouldn't be able to fission. The dead half of her body should dissipate. That is, unless it didn't really happen. That said, if mind-altering rays can be sent through a computer monitor to an oil painting where it can then rewrite someone's mind, I suppose I should be able to deal with Madame Rouge splitting in two.
It's unrealistic.
I know. As you said last week, Paul, how does this work? My favourite foursome is the Fantastic Four, but I'm going to say that it was during the time when Crystal was a member. I say this only because I love Crystal. Oh, thanks, Ange. And he does sign off. Looking forward to the new comic book coverage. Had my store pre-order it for me like a good comic buyer. Nicely done.
So, Mike, who is your favourite fictional foursome?
I'm going to be completely obvious and boring and say Doom Patrol, followed very, 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 very closely by King's Watch. Doom Patrol, because obviously I love them enough to do a podcast about them with my bestest friend, Paul. And King's Watch because of A, the characters are great. B, there is a familial connection there because my dad loved those characters back when they were just in, you know, comic strip form in the newspapers. And as a child, we would sit there and read them together. So lots of happy, feely, lovely memories there. But unfortunately, my father's no longer with us, and I just know he would have gone nuts for King's Watch. So that's something that I really enjoy about seeing those characters all together in the one book. It's so much fun. So much fun. What about you, Paul?
Well, I could say the Doom Patrol. That would be true. But I'm going to say the Banana Splits because I really love those guys growing up.
Paul, this is what, our 70th episode? I think that is my favouritest answer of yours ever.
Oh, really?
Oh, God. Just going to make a mental note for the outro music for this week. Okay.
What about you, Steve?
I mean, I've got to say the Fantastic Four, but I guess really it's actually, if you're familiar with Terry Pratchett, it's the original Night's Watch from Guards Guards, which is Nobby Knob, Sergeant Colon, Carrot, he wasn't a captain then, and Sergeant Vimes. Especially Vimes, but I love those characters, and any book with those in is instantly at the top of my list of favourite Terry Pratchett books, and probably just books in general.
Cool.
Oh.
Okay.
Now, if you should be on the Fantastic Cast with that answer.
I'll get in touch, see if they'll have me.
Cool. Well, it's been a very fun episode. Steve, thank you very much for joining us this week. Tell the listeners again where they can find you.
It's been brilliant fun doing this. Well worth getting up at 7 in the morning to be ready for this. So if you want to find me out there, my personal Twitter is @QuizLacey, but more importantly, my show, The Fantasticast, which I do with Andrew Leyland of Hey Kids Comics, you can find that at thefantasticast.com. We are @Fantasticast on Twitter, and just put Fantasticast into iTunes or any podcasting app and you'll find us.
Fantastic. Pun. Okay, so we're going to sign off for now. Next week is the moment we never thought would happen. We never imagined it once we started doing this show, but it's finally here. A brand new number one and new volume of Doom Patrol. I'm a little bit excited about this.
We are going to cover it. We're going to read it and we're going to talk about it.
Oh, I'm going to do so much more with it. Oh, I'm just going to...
Whoa!
I'm going to read it everywhere, even on the toilet.
Ooh. That's not going to be 10.0, is it?
And also next episode, Paul, what's our question of the week?
Okay, so we may have some people who are new to comics coming to listen. So we're asking, what is something you didn't know about comics at first?
Ooh, that's a loaded question.
Mm. Yeah.
So yes, as always, you can get in touch with us on Twitter @WFDpod. Say hi to Wilfred while you're there. You can email us at awaitingfordoom@gmail.com. You can also get in touch via the Facebook page where we've got Waiting for Doom. And you can also check out Doug Zavisha's blog, which is mygreatestadventure80.blogspot.com. And can I say, Doug did a fantastic post on our last episode with lots of colourful commentary and throwing a lot of shade at Beast Boy and Mento, which made me laugh out loud. And it was fantastic.
It was a ripper, that post.
Oh, it was so good. Okay, Paul, say goodnight to the folks.
Good night, everyone.
We'll catch you all next time for more Waiting for Doom.
Bye.